The chaplain paused, to allow a diplomatic period of time to pass before he pronounced the words, "I require and charge you both," when a clear voice declared, "I object." Emma and Harry both swung round to see who could possibly have uttered two such damning words. The chaplain looked up in disbelief, wondering for a moment if he had misheard, but all over the church heads were turning as the congregation tried to discover who had made the unexpected intervention. The chaplain had never experienced such a turn of events before, and tried desperately to recall what he was expected to do in the circumstances. Emma buried her head in Harry's shoulder, while he searched among the chattering congregation, trying to find out who it was who had caused such consternation. He assumed it must be Emma's father, but when he looked down at the front row, he saw Hugo Barrington, white as a sheet, was also trying to see who had brought the ceremony to a premature halt. The Reverend Styler had to raise his voice to be heard above the growing clamour. "Would the gentleman who has objected to this marriage taking place please make himself known?" A tall, upright figure stepped out into the aisle. Every eye remained fixed on Captain Jack Tarrant as he made his way up to the altar before coming to a halt in front of the chaplain. Emma clung on to Harry, fearful he was about to be prized away from her. "Am I to understand, sir," said the chaplain, "that you feel this marriage should not be allowed to proceed?"
"That is correct, sir," said old Jack quietly.
"Then I must ask you, the bride and groom, and the members of their immediate family, to join me in the vestry." Raising his voice, he added, "The congregation should remain in their places until I have considered the objection and made my decision known."
Those who had been bidden were led by the chaplain into the vestry, followed by Harry and Emma. Not one of them spoke, although the congregation continued to whisper noisily among themselves. Once the two families had crammed themselves into the tiny vestry, the Reverend Styler closed the door.
"Captain Tarrant," he began, "I must tell you that I alone am vested by law with the authority to decide whether this marriage should continue. Naturally, I shall not come to any decision until I have heard your objections."
The only person in that overcrowded room who appeared calm was old Jack.
"Thank you, Chaplain," he began.
"Firstly, I must apologize to you all, and in particular to Emma and Harry for my intervention. I have spent the past few weeks wrestling with my conscience before coming to this unhappy decision. I could have taken the easy way out and simply found some excuse for not attending this ceremony today. I have remained silent until now, in the hope that in time any objection would prove irrelevant. But sadly, that has not proved to be the case, for Harry and Emma's love for each other has in fact grown over the years and not diminished, which is why it has become impossible for me to remain silent any longer."
Everyone was so gripped by old Jack's words that only Elizabeth Barrington noticed her husband slip quietly out of the back door of the vestry.
"Thank you, Captain Tarrant," said the Reverend Styler. "While I accept your intervention in good faith, I need to know what specific charges you bring against these two young people."
"I bring no charge against Harry or Emma, both of whom I love and admire, and believe to be as much in the dark as the rest of you. No, my charge is against Hugo Barrington, who has known for many years that there is a possibility that he is the father of both of these unfortunate children."
A gasp went around the room as everyone tried to grasp the enormity of this statement. The chaplain said nothing until he was able to regain their attention.
"Is there anyone present who can verify or refute Captain Tarrant's claim?"
"This can't possibly be true," said Emma,
still clinging on to Harry. There must be some mistake. Surely my father can't...
That was the moment everyone became aware that the father of the bride was no longer among them.
The chaplain turned his attention to Mrs. Clifton, who was quietly sobbing.
"I can't deny Captain Tarrant's fears," she said haltingly.
It was some time before she continued.
"I confess I did have a relationship with Mr. Barrington on one occasion."
She paused again.
"Only once, but unfortunately it was just a few weeks before I married my husband."
She raised her head slowly.
"So I have no way of knowing who Harry's father is."
"I should point out to you all," said old Jack, "that Hugo Barrington threatened Mrs. Clifton on more than one occasion, should she ever reveal his dreadful secret."
"Mrs. Clifton, may I be allowed to ask you a question?" said Sir Walter gently.
Maisie nodded, although her head remained bowed.
"Did your late husband suffer from colour blindness?"
"Not that I'm aware of," she said, barely loudly enough to be heard.
Sir Walter turned to Harry. "But I believe you do, my boy."
"Yes, I do, sir," said Harry without hesitation.
"Why is that of any importance?"
"Because I am also colourblind," said Sir Walter, "as are my son and grandson. It is a hereditary trait that has troubled our family for several generations."
Harry took Emma in his arms.
"I swear to you, my darling, I didn't know anything about this."
"Of course you didn't," said Elizabeth Barrington, speaking for the first time. "The only man who knew was my husband, and he didn't have the courage to come forward and admit it. If he had, none of this need ever have happened."
"Father," she said, turning to Lord Harvey, "can I ask you to explain to our guests why the ceremony will not be continuing?"
Lord Harvey nodded.
"Leave it to me, old gal," he said, touching her gently on the arm. "But what are you going to do?"
"I'm going to take my daughter as far away from this place as possible."
"I don't want to go as far away as possible," Emma said, "unless it's with Harry."
"I fear your father has left us with no choice," said Elizabeth, taking her gently by the arm. But Emma continued to cling on to Harry until he whispered, "I'm afraid your mother's right, my darling. But one thing your father will never be able to do is stop me loving you. And if it takes the rest of my life, I'll prove he's not my father."
"Perhaps you'd prefer to leave by the rear entrance, Mrs. Barrington," suggested the chaplain. Emma reluctantly released Harry and allowed her mother to take her away. The chaplain led them out of the vestry and down a narrow corridor to a door that he was surprised to find unlocked.
"May God go with you, my children," he said, before letting them out.
Elizabeth accompanied her daughter around the outside of the church to the waiting Rolls Royces. She ignored those members of the congregation who had strayed outside for some fresh air or to smoke a cigarette, and now made no attempt to conceal their curiosity when they spotted the two women climbing unceremoniously into the back of the limousine. Elizabeth had opened the door of the first Rolls and bundled her daughter into the back seat before the chauffeur spotted them. He had stationed himself by the great door, as he hadn't expected the bride and groom to appear for at least another half an hour, when a peal of bells would announce the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Harry Clifton to the world. The moment the chauffeur heard the door slam, he stubbed out his cigarette, ran across to the car, and jumped behind the wheel.
"Take us back to the hotel," Elizabeth said.
Neither of them spoke again until they reached the safety of their room. Emma lay sobbing on the bed while Elizabeth stroked her hair the way she had when she was a child.
"What am I going to do?" cried Emma. "I can't suddenly stop loving Harry."
"I'm sure you never will," said her mother. "But fate has decreed that you cannot be together until it can be proved who Harry's father is." She continued to stroke her daughter's hair, and thought she might even have fallen asleep, until Emma quietly added, "What will I tell my child when they ask who their father is?"
Harry Clifton, 1939 to 1940. Chapter 48. The thing I remember most after Emma and her mother had left the church was how calm everyone appeared to be. No hysterics, no one fainted, there weren't even any raised voices. A visitor might have been forgiven for not realizing how many people's lives had just been irreparably damaged, even ruined. How very British, stiff upper lip and all that. No one willing to admit that their personal life had been shattered in the space of a single hour. Well, I have to admit, mine had. I had stood in numbed silence as the different actors played out their roles. Old Jack had done no more or less than what he considered his duty, though the pallor of his skin and the deeply etched lines on his face suggested otherwise. He could have taken the easy way out and simply declined our invitation to the wedding. But Victoria Cross winners don't walk away. Elizabeth Barrington was cast from that metal which, when put to the test, proved she was the equal of any man. A veritable Portia, who sadly hadn't married a Brutus. As I looked around the vestry, waiting for the chaplain to return, I felt saddest for Sir Walter, who had walked his granddaughter down the aisle and had not gained a grandson, but rather lost a son who, as old Jack had warned me so many years ago, was not cut from the same cloth as his father. My dear mother was fearful to respond when I tried to take her in my arms and reassure her of my love. She clearly believed she alone was to blame for everything that had taken place that day. And Giles, he became a man when his father crept out of the vestry to hide under some slimy stone, leaving the responsibility for his actions to others. In time, many of those present would become aware that what had taken place that day was every bit as devastating for Giles as for Emma. Finally, Lord Harvey. He was an example to us all of how to behave in a crisis. Once the chaplain had returned and explained the legal implications of consanguinity to us, we agreed among ourselves that Lord Harvey should address the waiting congregation on behalf of both families. "I would like Harry to stand on my right," he said, "as I wish everyone present to be left in no doubt, as my daughter Elizabeth made abundantly clear, that no blame rests on his shoulders." "Mrs. Clifton," he said, turning to my mother, "I hope you will be kind enough to stand on my left. Your courage in adversity has been an example to us all, and to one of us in particular. I hope that Captain Tarrant will stand by Harry's side. Only a fool blames the messenger. Giles should take his place beside him. Sir Walter, perhaps you would stand next to Mrs. Clifton while the rest of the family take their places behind us. Let me make it clear to you all," he continued, "that I only have one purpose in this tragic business, namely to ensure that everyone gathered in this church today will be in no doubt of our resolve in this matter, so that no one will ever say we were a divided house." Without another word, he led his small flock out of the vestry. When the chattering congregation saw us filing back into the church, Lord Harvey didn't need to call for silence. Each one of us took our allocated place on the altar steps as if we were about to pose for a family photograph that would later find its way into a wedding album. "Friends, if I may be so bold," began Lord Harvey, "I have been asked
to let you know on behalf of our two families that, sadly, the marriage between my granddaughter, Emma Barrington, and Mr. Harry Clifton will not be taking place today, or, for that matter, on any other day." Those last four words had a finality about them that was chilling when you were the only person present who still clung on to a vestige of hope that this might one day be resolved. "I must apologize to you all," he continued, "if you have been inconvenienced in any way, for that was surely not our purpose. May I conclude by thanking you for your presence here today, and wish you all a safe journey home." I wasn't sure what would happen next, but one or two members of the congregation rose from their places and began to make their way slowly out of the church. Within moments, the trickle turned into a steady stream, until finally those of us standing on the altar steps were the only ones remaining. Lord Harvey thanked the chaplain and warmly shook hands with me before accompanying his wife down the aisle and out of the church. It was the last time I ever saw him. My mother turned to me and tried to speak, but was overcome by her emotions. Old Jack came to our rescue, taking her gently by the arm and leading her away, while Sir Walter took Grace and Jessica under his wing. Not a day mothers or bridesmaids would want to recall for the rest of their lives. Giles and I were the last to leave. He had entered the church as my best man, and now he left it wondering if he was my half-brother. Some people stand by you in your darkest hour, while others walk away. Only a select few march towards you and become even closer friends. Once we had bidden farewell to the Reverend Styler, who seemed unable to find the words to express how sorry he felt, Giles and I trudged wearily across the cobbled stones of the quad and back to our college. Not a word passed between us as we climbed the wooden staircase to my rooms and sank into old leather chairs and young maudlin silence. We sat alone as day turned slowly into night, sparse conversation that had no sequence, no meaning, no logic. When the first long shadows appeared, those heralds of darkness that so often loosened the tongue, Giles asked me a question I hadn't thought about for years. "Do you remember the first time you and Deacons visited the manor house?" How could I forget? It was your 12th birthday, and your father refused to shake hands with me. Have you ever wondered why? "I think we found out the reason today," I said, trying not to sound too insensitive. "No, we didn't," said Giles quietly. "What we found out today was the possibility that Emma might be your half-sister. I now realize the reason my father kept his affair with your mother secret for so many years was because he was far more worried you might find out you were his son." "I don't understand the difference," I said, staring at him. "Then it's important for you to recall the only question my father asked on that occasion." "He asked when my birthday was." "That's right. And when he discovered you were a few weeks older than me, he left the room without another word. And later, when we had to leave to go back to school, he didn't come out of his study to say goodbye, even though it was my birthday. It wasn't until today that I realized the significance of his actions. How can that minor incident still be of any significance after all these years?" I asked. "Because that was the moment my father realized you might be his firstborn, and that when he dies, it could be you, not me, who inherits the family title, the business, and all his worldly goods." "But surely your father can leave his possessions to whomever he pleases, and that certainly wouldn't be me." "I wish it was that simple," said Giles. "But as my grandpa so regularly reminds me, his father, Sir Joshua Barrington, was knighted by Queen Victoria in 1877 for services to the shipping industry. In his will, he stated that all his titles, deeds, and possessions were to be left to the firstborn surviving son in perpetuity.
"But I have no interest in claiming what clearly is not mine," I said, trying to reassure him.
"I'm sure you don't," said Giles. "But you may have no choice in the matter, because in the fullness of time, the law will require you to take your place as head of the Barrington family."
Giles left me just after midnight to drive to Gloucestershire. He promised to find out if Emma was willing to see me, as we'd parted without even saying goodbye, and said he would return to Oxford the moment he had any news. I didn't sleep that night. So many thoughts were racing through my mind, and for a moment, just a moment, I even contemplated suicide. But I didn't need old Jack to remind me that that was the coward's way out. I didn't leave my rooms for the next 3 days. I didn't respond to gentle knocks on the door. I didn't answer the telephone when it rang. I didn't open the letters that were pushed under the door. It may have been inconsiderate of me not to respond to those who had only kindness in their hearts, but sometimes an abundance of sympathy can be more overwhelming than solitude. Giles returned to Oxford on the fourth day. He didn't need to speak for me to realize his news wasn't going to give me succor. It turned out to be far worse than I had even anticipated. Emma and her mother had left for Mulgelry Castle, where we had meant to be spending our honeymoon, with no relations to be allowed within 10 miles. Mrs. Barrington had instructed her solicitors to begin divorce proceedings, but they were unable to serve any papers on her husband, as no one had seen him since he'd crept unnoticed out of the vestry. Lord Harvey and old Jack had both resigned from the board of Barrington's, but out of respect for Sir Walter, neither had made their reasons for doing so public. Not that that would stop the rumour-mongers having a field day. My mother had left Eddie's nightclub and taken a job as a waitress in the dining room of the Grand Hotel.
"What about Emma?" I said. "Did you ask her?"
"I didn't have a chance to speak to her," said Giles. "They'd left for Scotland before I arrived. But she left a letter for you on the hall table." I could feel my heart beating faster as he handed me an envelope bearing her familiar handwriting. "If you feel like a little supper later, I'll be in my rooms."
"Thank you," I said, inadequately. I sat in my chair by the window overlooking Cobb's Quad, not wanting to open a letter that I knew wouldn't offer me a glimmer of hope. I finally tore open the envelope and extracted 3 pages, written in Emma's neat hand. Even then, it was some time before I could read her words.
The Manor House, Chew Valley, Gloucestershire, July 29th, 1939. My darling Harry, it's the middle of the night, and I am sitting in my bedroom writing to the only man I will ever love. Deep hatred for my father, whom I can never forgive, has been replaced by a sudden calm. So I must write these words before bitter recrimination returns to remind me of just how much that treacherous man has denied us both. I only wish we'd been allowed to part as lovers, and not as strangers in a crowded room, the fates having decided we should never say the words "until death do us part," although I am certain I will go to my grave only having loved one man. I will never be satisfied with just the memory of your love, for while there is the slightest hope that Arthur Clifton was your father, be assured, my darling, that I will remain constant. Mamma is convinced that, given enough time, the memory of you, like the evening sun, will fade and then finally disappear before heralding a new dawn. Does she not recall telling me on the day of my wedding that our love for each other was so pure, so simple, and so rare that it would unquestionably withstand the test of time, which Mamma confessed she could only envy as she had never experienced such happiness? But until I can be your wife, my darling, I am resolved that we must remain apart, unless, and until such time, it can be shown that we can be legally bound. No other man can hope to take your place, and, if necessary, I will remain single rather than settle for some counterfeit. I wonder if the day will dawn when I do not reach out, expecting to find you by my side, and if it will ever be possible to fall asleep without whispering your name. I would happily sacrifice the rest of my life to spend another year like the one we have just shared together, and no law made by God or man can change that. I still pray that the day will come when we can be joined together in the sight of that same God and those same men. But until then, my darling, I will always be your loving wife in all but name. Emma.
Chapter 49. When Harry finally summoned up the strength to open the countless letters that littered the floor, he came across one from old Jack's secretary in London.
Soho Square, London, Wednesday, August 2nd, 1939. Dear Mr. Clifton, you may not receive this letter until you've returned from your honeymoon in Scotland, but I wondered if Captain Tarrant stayed on in Oxford after the wedding. He didn't return to the office on Monday morning, and he hasn't been seen since, so I wondered if you had any idea where I might contact him. I look forward to hearing from you. Yours sincerely, Phyllis Watson.
Old Jack had clearly forgotten to let Miss Watson know he was going down to Bristol to spend a few days with Sir Walter. To make it clear that although he had caused the wedding to be abandoned and had resigned from the board of Barrington's, he remained a close friend of the chairman's. As there wasn't a second letter from Miss Watson among his pile of unopened mail, Harry assumed that old Jack must have returned to Soho Square and be back behind his desk. Harry spent the morning answering every one of the letters he'd left unopened. So many kind people offering sympathy. It wasn't their fault they reminded him of his unhappiness. Suddenly, Harry decided he had to be as far away from Oxford as possible. He picked up the phone and told the operator he wanted to make a long-distance call to London. Half an hour later, she called back to tell him the number was continually engaged. Next, he tried Sir Walter at Barrington Hall, but the number just rang and rang. Frustrated by his failure to contact either of them, Harry decided to follow one of old Jack's maxims. Get off your backside and do something positive. He grabbed the suitcase he had packed for his honeymoon in Scotland, walked across to the lodge, and told the porter he was going up to London and wouldn't be returning until the first day of term. Should Giles Barrington ask where I am, he added, please tell him I've gone to work for old Jack. Old Jack, repeated the porter, writing the name down on a slip of paper. On the train journey to Paddington, Harry read in the Times about the latest communiques that were bouncing back and forth between the Foreign Office in London and the Reich Ministry in Berlin. He was beginning to think that Mr. Chamberlain was the only person who still believed in the possibility of peace in our time. The Times was predicting that Britain would be at war within days, and that the Prime Minister couldn't hope to survive in office if the Germans defied his ultimatum and marched into Poland. The Thunderer went on to suggest that in that eventuality, a coalition government would have to be formed, led by the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, a safe pair of hands, and not the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, unpredictable and irascible. Despite the paper's obvious distaste for Churchill, Harry didn't believe that Britain needed a safe pair of hands at this particular moment in history, but someone who was not frightened to bully a bully. When Harry stepped off the train at Paddington, he was met by a wave of different coloured uniforms coming at him from every direction. He'd already decided which service he would join the moment war was declared. A morbid thought crossed his mind as he boarded a bus for Piccadilly Circus. If he was killed while serving his country, it would solve all the Barrington family's problems, except one.
When the bus reached Piccadilly, Harry jumped off and began to weave his way through the clowns that made up the West End Circus, through Theatreland, and on past exclusive restaurants and overpriced nightclubs, which appeared determined to ignore any suggestion of war. The queue of displaced immigrants trooping in and out of the building in Soho Square appeared even longer and more bedraggled than on Harry's first visit. Once again, as he climbed the stairs to the third floor, several of the refugees stood aside, assuming he must be a member of staff. He hoped he would be, within the hour. When he reached the third floor, he headed straight for Miss Watson's office. He found her filling in forms, issuing rail warrants, arranging accommodation, and handing out small amounts of cash to desperate people. Her face lit up when she saw Harry. "Do tell me Captain Tarrant's with you," were her first words. "No, he isn't," said Harry. "I assumed he'd returned to London, which is why I'm here. I was wondering if you might be able to use an extra pair of hands." "That's very kind of you, Harry," she said. "But the most useful thing you could do for me right now is to find Captain Tarrant. This place is bursting at the seams without him." "The last I heard, he was staying with Sir Walter Barrington at his home in Gloucester," said Harry. "But that was at least a fortnight ago." "We haven't set eyes on him since the day he went to Oxford for your wedding," said Miss Watson, as she tried to comfort two more immigrants who couldn't speak a word of English. "Has anyone phoned his flat to see if he's there?" asked Harry. "He doesn't have a phone," said Miss Watson, "and I've hardly been to my own home for the past 2 weeks," she added, nodding in the direction of a queue that stretched as far as the eye could see. "Why don't I start there and report back to you?" "Would you?" said Miss Watson, as two little girls began sobbing. "Don't cry. Everything's going to be all right," she reassured the children as she knelt and placed an arm round them. "Where does he live?" asked Harry. "Number 23, Prince Edward Mansions, Lambeth Walk. Take the number 11 bus to Lambeth, then you'll have to ask for directions. And thank you, Harry." Harry turned and headed towards the stairs. Something wasn't right, he thought. Old Jack would never have deserted his post without giving Miss Watson a reason. "I forgot to ask," Miss Watson shouted after him. "How was your honeymoon?" Harry felt he was far enough away not to have heard her. Back at Piccadilly Circus, he boarded a double-decker bus overcrowded with soldiers. It drove down Whitehall, which was full of officers, and on through Parliament Square, where a vast crowd of onlookers was waiting for any snippets of information that might come out of the House of Commons. The bus continued its journey across Lambeth Bridge, and Harry got off when it reached Albert Embankment. A paper boy, who was shouting, "Britain awaits Hitler's response," told Harry to take the second on the left, then the third on the right, and added for good measure, "I thought everyone knew where Lambeth Walk was." Harry began to run like a man being pursued, and he didn't stop until he came to a block of flats that was so dilapidated he could only wonder which Prince Edward it had been named after. He pushed open a door that wouldn't survive much longer on those hinges and walked quickly up a flight of stairs, stepping nimbly between piles of rubbish that hadn't been cleared for days. When he reached the second floor, he stopped outside number 23 and knocked firmly on the door. But there was no reply. He knocked again, louder, but still no one responded. He ran back down the stairs in search of someone who worked in the building, and when he reached the basement, he found an old man slumped in an even older chair, smoking a roll-up and flicking through the pages of the Daily Mirror. "Have you seen Captain Tarrant recently?" Harry asked sharply. "Not for the past couple of weeks, sir," said the man, leaping to his feet and almost standing to attention when he heard Harry's accent. "Do you have a master key that will open his flat?" asked Harry. "I do, sir, but I'm not allowed to use it except in emergencies." "I can assure you this is an emergency," said Harry, who turned and bounded back up the stairs, not waiting for his reply. The man followed, if not quite as quickly. Once he'd caught up, he opened the door. Harry moved quickly from room to room, but there was no sign of old Jack. The last door he came to was closed.
He knocked quietly, fearing the worst. When there was no reply, he cautiously went in to find a neatly made bed and no sign of anyone. "He must still be with Sir Walter," was Harry's first thought.
He thanked the porter, walked back down the stairs and out onto the street as he tried to gather his thoughts. He hailed a passing taxi, not wanting to waste any more time on buses in a city that did not know him.
"Paddington Station. I'm in a hurry."
"Everyone seems to be in a hurry today," said the cabbie as he moved off.
20 minutes later, Harry was standing on Platform 6, but it was another 50 minutes before the train would depart for Temple Meads. He used the time to grab a sandwich and a cup of tea. "Only got cheese, sir?"
And to phone Miss Watson to let her know that old Jack hadn't been back to his flat. If it was possible, she sounded even more harassed than when he had left her.
"I'm on my way to Bristol," he told her. "I'll ring you as soon as I catch up with him."
As the train made its way out of the capital, through the smog-filled back streets of the city, and into the clean air of the countryside, Harry decided he had no choice but to go straight to Sir Walter's office at the dockyard, even if it meant running into Hugo Barrington. Finding old Jack surely outweighed any other consideration. Once the train shunted into Temple Meads, Harry knew the two buses he needed to catch without having to ask the paper boy who was standing on the corner, bellowing, "Britain awaiting Hitler's response," at the top of his voice. Same headline, but this time a Bristolian accent. 30 minutes later, Harry was at the dockyard gates.
"Can I help you?" asked a guard who didn't recognize him.
"I have an appointment with Sir Walter," said Harry, hoping this would not be questioned.
"Of course, sir. Do you know the way to his office?"
"Yes, thank you," said Harry. He started walking slowly towards a building he'd never entered before. He began to think about what he would do if he came face to face with Hugo Barrington before he reached Sir Walter's office. He was pleased to see the chairman's Rolls-Royce parked in its usual place, and even more relieved that there was no sign of Hugo Barrington's Bugatti. He was just about to enter Barrington House when he glanced at the railway carriage in the distance. Was it just possible? He changed direction and walked towards the Pullman Wagon Lee, as old Jack was wont to describe it after a second glass of whiskey. When Harry reached the carriage, he knocked gently on the glass pane as if it were a grand home. A butler did not appear, so he opened the door and climbed in. He walked along the corridor to first class, and there he was, sitting in his usual seat. It was the first time Harry had ever seen old Jack wearing his Victoria Cross. Harry took the seat opposite his friend and recalled the first time he'd sat there. He must have been about 5, and his feet hadn't reached the ground. Then he thought of the time he'd run away from St. Bede's, and the shrewd old gentleman had persuaded him to be back in time for breakfast. He recalled when old Jack had come to hear him sing a solo in the church, the time his voice had broken. Old Jack had dismissed this as a minor setback. Then there was the day he learnt he'd failed to win a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School, a major setback. Despite his failure, old Jack had presented him with the Ingersoll watch he was still wearing today. It must have cost him every penny he possessed. In Harry's last year at school, old Jack had travelled down from London to see him playing Romeo, and Harry had introduced him to Emma for the first time. And he would never forget his final speech day, when Jack had sat on stage as a governor of his old school and watched Harry being awarded the English prize. And now Harry would never be able to thank him for so many acts of friendship over the years that couldn't be repaid. He stared at a man he'd loved and had assumed would never die. As they sat there together in first class, the sun went down on his young life.
Chapter 50.
Harry watched as the stretcher was placed in the ambulance. A heart attack, the doctor had said, before the ambulance drove away. Harry didn't need to go and tell Sir Walter that old Jack was dead, because when he woke the following morning, the chairman of Barrington's was sitting by his side. "He told me he no longer had any reason to live," were Sir Walter's first words. "We have both lost a close and dear friend." Harry's response took Sir Walter by surprise. "What will you do with this carriage, now that old Jack is no longer around?"
"No one will be allowed anywhere near it, as long as I'm chairman," said Sir Walter. "It harbours too many personal memories for me."
"Me too," said Harry.
"I spent more time here when I was a boy than I did in my own home."
"Or in the classroom, for that matter," said Sir Walter with a wry smile.
"I used to watch you from my office window. I thought what an impressive child you must be if old Jack was willing to spend so much time with you."
Harry smiled when he remembered how old Jack had come up with a reason why he should go back to school and learn to read and write.
"What will you do now, Harry? Return to Oxford and continue with your studies?"
"No, sir. I fear that we'll be at war by the end of the month, would be my guess," said Sir Walter.
"Then I'll leave Oxford immediately and join the Navy. I've already told my college supervisor, Mr. Bainbridge, that that's what I plan to do. He assured me I can return and continue with my studies as soon as the war is over."
"Typical of Oxford," said Sir Walter. "They always take the long view."
"So will you go to Dartmouth and train as a naval officer?"
"No, sir. I've been around ships all my life. In any case, old Jack started out as a private soldier and managed to work his way up through the ranks, so why shouldn't I?"
"Why not indeed," said Sir Walter. "In fact, that was one of the reasons he was always considered to be a class above the rest of us who served with him."
"I had no idea you'd served together."
"Oh, yes. I served with Captain Tarrant in South Africa," said Sir Walter. "I was one of the 24 men whose lives he saved on the day he was awarded the Victoria Cross."
"That explains so much that I've never really understood," said Harry.
He then surprised Sir Walter a second time.
"Do I know any of the others, sir?"
"The Frobe," said Sir Walter. "But in those days he was Lieutenant Frobisher. Corporal Holcomb, Mr. Holcomb's father, and young Private Deakins."
"Deakins' father?" said Harry.
"Yes, Sprog, as we used to call him, a fine young soldier. He never said much, but he turned out to be very brave. Lost an arm on that dreadful day."
The two men fell silent, each lost in his own thoughts of old Jack, before Sir Walter asked,
"So, if you're not going to Dartmouth, my boy, may I ask how you plan to win the war single-handed?"
"I'll serve on any ship that will take me, sir, as long as they're willing to go in search of His Britannic Majesty's enemies. Then it's possible I may be able to help."
"That's kind of you, sir, but I want to join a warship, not a passenger liner or a cargo vessel."
Sir Walter smiled again. "And so you will, dear boy. Don't forget, I'm kept informed about every ship that comes in and out of these docks, and I know most of their captains. Come to think of it, I knew most of their fathers when they were captains. Why don't we go up to my office and see what ships are due in and out of the port in the next few days, and, more important, find out if any of them might be willing to take you on?"
"That's very decent of you, sir. But would it be all right if I visited my mother first? I might not have the chance to see her again for some time."
"Only right and proper, my boy," said Sir Walter. "And once you've been to see your mother, why don't you drop into my office later this afternoon? That should give me enough time to check on the latest shipping lists."
"Thank you, sir. I'll return as soon as I've told my mother what I plan to do."
"When you come back, just tell the man on the gate you've got an appointment with the chairman. Then you shouldn't have any trouble getting past security."
"Thank you, sir," said Harry, masking a smile.
"And do pass on my kindest regards to your dear mother."
a remarkable woman.
Harry was reminded why Sir Walter was old Jack's closest friend.
Harry walked into the Grand Hotel, a magnificent Victorian building in the centre of the city, and asked the doorman the way to the dining room. He walked across the lobby and was surprised to find a small queue at the maitre d's desk, waiting to be allocated tables. He joined the back of the queue, recalling how his mother had always disapproved of him dropping in to see her at Tilly's or the Royal Hotel during working hours. While Harry waited, he looked around the dining room, which was full of chattering people, none of whom looked as if they were anticipating a food shortage or thinking of enlisting in the armed forces should the country go to war. Food was being whisked in and out of the swing doors on heavily laden silver trays, while a man in a chef's outfit was wheeling a trolley from table to table, slicing off slivers of beef, while another followed in his wake, carrying a gravy boat. Harry could see no sign of his mother. He was even beginning to wonder if Giles had only told him what he wanted to hear, when suddenly she burst through the swing doors, three plates balanced on her arms. She placed them in front of her customers so deftly they hardly noticed she was there, then returned to the kitchen. She was back a moment later, carrying three vegetable dishes. By the time Harry had reached the front of the queue, he'd been reminded of who had given him his boundless energy, uncritical enthusiasm, and a spirit that didn't contemplate defeat. How would he ever be able to repay this remarkable woman for all the sacrifices she had made?
"I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, sir," said the maitre d', interrupting his thoughts, "but I don't have a table available at the moment. If you'd care to come back in about 20 minutes?"
Harry didn't tell him he didn't actually want a table, and not just because his mother was one of the waitresses, but because he wouldn't have been able to afford anything on the menu other than perhaps the gravy.
"I'll come back later," he said, trying to sound disappointed.
About 10 years later, he thought, by which time he suspected his mother would probably be the maitre d'. He left the hotel with a smile on his face and took a bus back to the docks. He was ushered straight through to Sir Walter's office by his secretary and found the chairman leaning on his desk, peering down at the port schedules, timetables, and ocean charts that covered every inch of its surface. "Have a seat, dear boy," said Sir Walter, before fixing his monocle in his right eye and looking sternly at Harry. "I've had a little time to think about our conversation this morning," he continued, sounding very serious, "and before we go any further, I need to be convinced that you're making the right decision." "I'm absolutely certain," said Harry, without hesitation. "That may be, but I'm equally certain that Jack would have advised you to return to Oxford and wait until you were called up."
"He may well have done so, sir, but he wouldn't have taken his own advice."
"How well you knew him," said Sir Walter. "Indeed, that's exactly what I expected you to say. Let me tell you what I've come up with so far," he continued, returning his attention to the papers that covered his desk. "The good news is that the Royal Navy battleship HMS Resolution is due to dock at Bristol in about a month's time, when it will refuel before awaiting further orders."
"A month?" said Harry, making no attempt to hide his frustration.
"Patience, boy," said Sir Walter. "The reason I chose the Resolution is because the captain is an old friend, and I'm confident I can get you on board as a deckhand, as long as the other part of my plan works out."
"But would the captain of the Resolution consider taking on someone with no seafaring experience?"
"Probably not. But if everything else falls into place, by the time you board the Resolution, you will be an old sea dog."
Recalling one of old Jack's favourite homilies, "I find I don't learn a lot while I'm talking," Harry decided to stop interrupting and start listening.
"Now," Sir Walter continued, "I've identified three ships that are due to leave Bristol in the next 24 hours and are expected to return within 3 to 4 weeks, which will give you more than enough time to sign up as a deckhand on the Resolution."
Harry wanted to interrupt, but didn't.
"Let's begin with my first choice.
The Devonian is bound for Cuba, with a manifest of cotton dresses, potatoes, and Raleigh-Lenton bicycles, and is due to return to Bristol in 4 weeks' time, with a cargo of tobacco, sugar, and bananas. The second ship on my shortlist is the SS Kansas Star, a passenger vessel that will be sailing to New York on the first tide tomorrow. It has been requisitioned by the United States government to transport American nationals back home before Britain finds itself at war with Germany. The third is an empty oil tanker, the SS Princess Beatrice, which is on its way back to Amsterdam to refuel, and will return to Bristol with a full load before the end of the month. All three skippers are painfully aware that they need to be safely back in port as quickly as possible, because if war is declared, the two merchant vessels will be considered fair game by the Germans, while only the Kansas Star will be safe from the German U-boats skulking around the Atlantic, just waiting for the order to sink anything flying a red or blue ensign. "What crew are these ships in need of?" asked Harry. "I'm not exactly overqualified." Sir Walter searched around his desk again before extracting another sheet of paper. "The Princess Beatrice is short of a deckhand. The Kansas Star is looking for someone to work in the kitchens, which usually means as a washer-upper or a waiter, while the Devonian needs a fourth officer. So that one can be removed from the shortlist." "Funnily enough," said Sir Walter, "that's the position I consider you best qualified for. The Devonian has a crew of 37 and rarely goes to sea with a trainee officer, so no one would expect you to be anything other than a novice." "But why would the captain consider me?" "Because I told him you were my grandson." Chapter 51. Harry walked along the dock towards the Devonian. The small suitcase he was carrying made him feel like a schoolboy on his first day of term. What would the headmaster be like? Would he sleep in a bed next to a Giles or a Deakins? Would he come across an old Jack? Would there be a Fisher on board? Although Sir Walter had offered to accompany him and introduce him to the captain, Harry had felt that would not be the best way to endear himself to his new shipmates. He stopped for a moment and looked closely at the ancient vessel on which he would be spending the next month. Sir Walter had told him that the Devonian had been built in 1913, when the oceans were still dominated by sail, and a motorized cargo vessel would have been thought the latest thing. But now, 26 years later, it wouldn't be too long before she was decommissioned and taken to that area of the docks where old ships are broken up and their parts sold for scrap. Sir Walter had also hinted that as Captain Havens only had one more year to serve before he retired, the owners might decide to scrap him at the same time as his ship. The Devonian's articles of agreement showed a crew of 37, but as on so many cargo ships, that number wasn't quite accurate. A cook and a washer-up picked up in Hong Kong didn't appear on the payroll, nor did the occasional deckhand or two, who was fleeing the law and had no desire to return to his homeland. Harry made his way slowly up the gangway. Once he'd stepped on deck, he didn't move until he'd received permission to board. After all his years of hanging around the docks, he was well aware of ship's protocol. He looked up at the bridge and assumed the man he saw giving orders must be Captain Havens. Sir Walter had told him the senior officer on a cargo vessel was in fact a master mariner, but should always be addressed on board as captain. Captain Havens was a shade under 6 foot and looked nearer 50 than 60. He was stockily built, with a weathered, tanned face and a dark, neatly trimmed beard that, as he was going bald, made him look like George V. When he spotted Harry waiting at the top of the gangway, the captain gave a crisp order to the officer standing next to him on the bridge before making his way down onto the deck. "I'm Captain Havens," he said briskly. "You must be Harry Clifton." He shook Harry warmly by the hand. "Welcome aboard the Devonian. You come highly recommended."
"'I should point out, sir,' began Harry, "'that this is my first—'
"'I'm aware of that,' said Havens, lowering his voice. "'But I'd keep it to yourself if you don't want your time on board to be a living hell. "'And whatever you do, don't mention you were at Oxford, "'because most of this lot,' he said, indicating the seamen working on the deck, "'will think it's just the name of another ship. "'Follow me. I'll show you the fourth officer's quarters.'
Harry followed in the captain's wake, aware that a dozen suspicious eyes were watching his every move.
"'There are two other officers on my ship,' said the captain, once Harry had caught up with him. "'Jim Patterson, the senior engineer, spends most of his life down below in the boiler room, so you'll only see him at mealtimes, and sometimes not even then. He's served with me for the past 14 years, and frankly I doubt if this old lady would still make it halfway across the Channel, let alone the Atlantic,' if he wasn't down there to coax her along. My third officer, Tom Bradshaw, is on the bridge. He's only been with me for 3 years, so he's not yet earned his ticket. He keeps himself to himself, but whoever trained him knew what they were doing, because he's a damn fine officer.
Havens began to disappear down a narrow stairwell that led to the deck below.
That's my cabin, he said, as he continued down the corridor, and that's Mr. Patterson's.
He came to a halt in front of what appeared to be a broom cupboard.
"'This is your cabin.'
He pushed the door open, but it only moved a few inches before it banged against a narrow wooden bed.
"'I won't come in as there isn't room for both of us. You'll find some clothes on the bed. Once you've changed, join me on the bridge. We'll be setting sail within the hour. Leaving the harbor will probably be the most interesting part of the voyage until we dock in Cuba.'
Harry squeezed through the half-open door and had to close it behind him to allow enough room to change his clothes. He checked the gear that had been left neatly folded on his bunk. 2 thick blue sweaters, 2 white shirts, 2 pairs of blue trousers, 3 pairs of blue woolen socks, and a pair of canvas shoes with thick rubber soles. It really was like being back at school. Every item had one thing in common. They all looked as if they'd been worn by several other people before Harry. He quickly changed into his seaman's gear, then unpacked his suitcase. As there was only one drawer, Harry placed the little suitcase, full of his civilian clothes, under the bed, the only thing in the cabin that fitted perfectly. He opened the door, squeezed back into the corridor, and went in search of the stairwell. Once he'd located it, he emerged back on deck. Several more pairs of suspicious eyes followed his progress.
"'Mr. Clifton,' said the captain as Harry stepped onto the bridge for the first time, "'this is Tom Bradshaw, the third officer, who will be taking the ship out of the harbour as soon as we've been given clearance by the port authority.' "'By the way, Mr. Bradshaw,' said Havens, "'one of our tasks on this voyage will be to teach this young pup everything we know,' so that when we return to Bristol in a month's time, the crew of HMS Resolution will mistake him for an old sea dog.
If Mr. Bradshaw commented, his words were drowned by 2 long blasts on a siren, a sound Harry had heard many times over the years, indicating that the 2 tugboats were in place and waiting to escort the Devonian out of the harbour. The captain pressed some tobacco into his well-worn briar pipe, while Mr. Bradshaw acknowledged the signal with 2 blasts of the ship's horn to confirm that the Devonian was ready to depart.
"'Prepare to cast off, Mr. Bradshaw,' said Captain Havens, striking a match.
Mr. Bradshaw removed the cover from a brass voice pipe Harry hadn't noticed until that moment.
"'All engines slow ahead, Mr. Patterson. The tugboats are in place and ready to escort us out of harbor,' he added, revealing a slight American accent. "'All engines slow ahead, Mr. Bradshaw,' came back a voice from the boiler room.
Harry looked down over the side of the bridge and watched as the crew carried out their allotted tasks. 4 men, 2 at the bow and 2 at the stern, were unwinding thick ropes from the capstans on the dock. Another 2 were hauling up the gangway.
"'Keep your eye on the pilot,' said the captain between puffs on his pipe. "'It's his responsibility to guide us out of the harbour and safely into the Channel. "'Once he's done that, Mr. Bradshaw will take over. "'If you turn out to be any good, Mr. Clifton,
you may be allowed to take his place in about a year's time. But not until I've retired, and Mr. Bradshaw has taken over command."
As Bradshaw didn't give even the flicker of a smile, Harry remained silent and continued to watch everything going on around him.
"No one is allowed to take my girl out at night," continued Captain Havens, "unless I'm sure he won't take any liberties with her."
Again, Bradshaw didn't smile, but then he may have heard the comment before.
Harry found himself fascinated by how smoothly the whole operation was carried out. The Devonian eased away from the quayside, and, with the help of the two tugboats, nosed her way slowly out of the docks, along the River Avon and under the suspension bridge.
"Do you know who built that bridge, Mr. Clifton?"
the captain asked, taking his pipe out of his mouth.
"Isambard Kingdom Brunel, sir," said Harry.
"And why did he never live to see it opened?"
"Because the local council ran out of money, and he died before the bridge was completed."
The captain scowled.
"Next you'll be telling me it's named after you," he said, putting his pipe back in his mouth.
He didn't speak again until the tugboats had reached Barry Island, when they gave two more long blasts, released their lines, and headed back to port. The Devonian may have been an old lady, but it soon became clear to Harry that Captain Havens and his crew knew exactly how to handle her.
"Take over, Mr. Bradshaw," said the captain, as another pair of eyes appeared on the bridge, their owner carrying two mugs of hot tea. "There will be three officers on the bridge during this crossing, Lou, so be sure that Mr. Clifton also gets a mug of tea."
The Chinaman nodded and disappeared below deck.
Once the harbour lights had disappeared over the horizon, the waves became larger and larger, causing the ship to roll from side to side. Havens and Bradshaw stood feet apart, appearing to be glued to the deck, while Harry found himself regularly having to cling on to something to make sure he didn't fall over. When the Chinaman reappeared with a third mug of tea, Harry chose not to mention to the captain that it was cold and that his mother usually added a lump of sugar. Just as Harry was beginning to feel a little more confident, almost enjoying the experience, the captain said,
"Not much more you can do tonight, Mr. Clifton. Why don't you go below and try to catch some shut-eye? Be back on the bridge by 7:20 to take over the breakfast watch."
Harry was about to protest when a smile appeared on Mr. Bradshaw's face for the first time.
"Good night, sir," said Harry, before making his way down the steps and onto the deck. He wobbled slowly towards the narrow stairwell, feeling with every step he took that he was being watched.